My name is Lauren Cannon. I live over in the Seacoast in Newmarket and work in Portsmouth. I am part of the Peace Response New Hampshire group that came together after 9/11. And Peace Response New Hampshire is just one of the sponsors of this event this evening. We are pleased that the American Friends Service Committee of New Hampshire and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee of New Hampshire, New Hampshire Peace Action, and Peace Response New Hampshire have collaborated to bring us our evening speaker. We want to just start with a few thank yous. It's really a pleasure to welcome you to UNH Manchester, to such a wonderful forum here. We're grateful for all the help from UNH and the good parking out back, which somehow I missed my cue that was right there. That makes it easy. And particularly to Doug Grant for arranging all of that. Where's Doug? Thank you. Many people worked to get Scott here. As you may have read, he's just very recently back, and we wanted to get him up here as soon as possible. And we particularly want to thank Scott's community for letting him be with us this evening. You'll hear more in a moment, but they're very busy with various projects right now, so we're grateful for his time to come up. Tom Jackson did a lot of the publicity, and he'll be videotaping the program tonight so we can continue to share it. And I don't know if I saw Russ Perkins yet. Is he here? Russ provided our posters, thanks to Madeira Graphics in Laconia. And if you haven't seen Russ's work, you can see it on your way out. It's on the door there. But we are going to start with just a brief word from Nabil Megali, who some of you probably know, is president of the New Hampshire Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee.
Good evening. I ask for a few minutes to remember Haris Al-Maqsood. Hala was the president of ADC from 1996 to 2001. She passed away on the 26th of April. She was 59. Hala is one of the founders of ADC in 1980. In addition to her work with ADC, she helped found many organizations, civil rights organizations, including the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the AUG, American Association of University Graduates, the American Committee on Jerusalem, and the Arab Women's Council. In March this year, she received a Life Achievement Award for civil rights activism from the Foundation of American Immigration Law as a civil rights leader. Hala was a great leader. She was a great inspiration for all of us. She was a sister, and we'll definitely miss her. And I would like just to ask you for a moment to remember Hala and all other civil rights leaders who are not with us now. As we meet now, right now, her 40th day memorial is held in Washington, D.C., today is the 40th day, and the Middle East will celebrate a memorial at the 40th day of death. So our heart, our spirits are there, and thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Well, it is my entire pleasure to welcome Scott Schaefer Duffy to us this evening. This will be extremely brief because Scott has an hour program for us, and we'll have time for question and answer if we can all agree to really try to be quite brief and give everyone a chance to speak. I know that tonight will be a very informative program. Scott will be presenting tonight From Suffering to Peace in Israel and Palestine, the slides from his most recent trip just back, returning on April 17th. Scott has a religious studies degree from Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. He is married to peace activist and freelance journalist Claire Schaefer Duffy, who actually is preparing to leave in just a few days to head over to Afghanistan with another delegation. Together they have four children who I've had the pleasure to meet, who are just tremendous. Claire and Scott are founding members of the St. Francis and Therese Catholic Worker in Worcester, Massachusetts, where they live and work, sheltering the homeless and promoting peace. And if you ever want to see the good work in action, just take a quick stop down there to Worcester. Although most of their peace work has been domestic, they have traveled to Nicaragua, Bosnia, India, Iraq, and Israel-Palestine as part of fact-finding and peace campaigns. I myself met Scott as we headed off for a trip to Iraq in 98, and as I'm sure he did on this latest mission, he kept many of us in good humor while touring some of the most unspeakable, horrendous suffering you can imagine, and really kept many of us in line, I think. Scott was a member of the first international delegation to enter the sites in the occupied territories immediately after they were attacked. And you will hear that, like many people, this team was told they could not enter, but they did not take no for an answer, and they found a way in. Scott will discuss his firsthand view of conditions in Ramallah, Jenin, and Bethlehem with us. So please help me welcome Scott Chapman.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm going to speak without a microphone, and I'm going to try to speak very loudly. And if anyone can't hear me, please say so. I want to be real respectful to make sure everybody can hear me. Usually in my house, we have the opposite problem where my voice is too loud. But some of these slides are not from the most recent trip. They're from one of my five previous trips. And I think it's important to contextualize a little history, a little background, and a little things that lead up to the current situation. And I apologize to everyone that the history is so truncated, because trying to give a 10-minute history of that region is trying to put an elephant in a peanut shell. So I apologize for the limitations of that, and I try to make it as accurate and as fair as possible. So if someone could get the lights. Everyone has a bias, and I have to admit my primary bias in all of this is I am a pacifist. I am opposed to violence by all people. This slide was taken by my friend Gary Shapiro, who's a grandson of Holocaust survivors, and it was during a peace mission that we did together in Bosnia during that war. And death is very capricious, and it strikes people of all religions and political stripes, and it's something that I oppose in all of its manifestations. And so that's, I'd like to just say that at the beginning. That's my predominant bias. Now, as many of you probably already know, Israel was founded in 1947 when the United Nations voted to partition the former UN, former British protectorate of Palestine into an Israeli and a Palestinian state. 52% of the land was designated as Israel, 48% as Palestine. The Israelis accepted that partition, the Palestinians and the surrounding Arab states did not. There was an immediate war, at the end of which time Israel was left in control of 80% of historic Palestine, and the remaining areas were taken over by Jordan and by Egypt. There were a number of other, and many of the Palestinians who formerly lived inside Israeli territory now found themselves as refugees. Initially, these refugees lived in tents and camps administered by the UN. Gradually, over the years, they came to live in more substantial structures, but nonetheless crowded, impoverished, and a very, very difficult life. These refugee camps are really the centers of opposition to Israeli rule and of criticism of Israel, because these people feel that they wanted their land back, they wanted compensation and those sort of things. The Jordanian and Egyptian rule continued until 1967, when in what Israelis describe as a preemptive strike, they attacked those countries in Syria and conquered the Golan Heights, the West Bank of the Jordan River from Jordan, and the Gaza Strip from Egypt. Those areas are commonly referred to today as the occupied territories. UN Resolution 242, which the United States signed, called for the withdrawal of Israelis from those territories. And that's been the bone of contention since that time. That occupation has taken many forms. I first went there in 1988 when I stayed in this refugee camp, the Rafah refugee camp in Gaza. In my first 24 hours there, an elderly Palestinian man and a four-year-old were killed by Israeli troops. A curfew was declared. Soldiers fired tear gas into a shuttered building next door. And life was made very, very, very difficult. The occupation also took all kinds of administrative forms. Very, very early on, Palestinians found themselves under military rule or under administrative rule, which had required them to receive permits for almost any activities. So this was one of their common early experiences, not only those that lived in refugee camps, but all of those, that at any point, no matter who you were, PhD, doctor, lawyer, you had to get permits for building, permits for travel, permits for, in some cases, permits to go to hospitals, permits to go into Israel and use the airport, or so on. And they could be denied very, very, very easily. Sometimes people would wait 4 or 5 days in front of an office like this to gain these permits. On the morning of my second day in 1988, an Israeli soldier fired a tear gas canister into a shuttered home, and we heard screams in that home, and then a doctor in the building I was staying in burst through the locked door and pulled out a six-month-old and a two-year-old child. The two-year-old was crying and coughing. The six-month-old was unconscious and later died. Minutes later, they retrieved the tear gas canister and put it in my hands, still hot, and it said on the canister, Federal Laboratories, Salzburg, Pennsylvania, USA. And below that it said in capital letters, for outdoor use only, indoor use may cause injury or death. So it was a kind of a rude awakening and an introduction to the American connection to the occupation. During that same trip, which was actually organized by the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, what they did is they sent 15 non-Arab Americans to go live with Palestinian families for 30 days. And then gave us a free hand to write any kind of report we wanted on what we observed. During that time, we observed, in 88, we observed people who were beaten. I met a man, a truck driver, who was taken from his truck. His hand was put on a cinder block, and Israeli soldiers using rifle butts broke every bone in his finger, and every bone in his hand. I saw children whose eyes had been shot out with steel-encased rubber bullets. I interviewed young men in hospitals who had been wounded with live fire. One of the things that I quickly learned, none of these people wanted their faces photographed, and especially those who were injured. And the reason for that is, in the crowded refugee camps and crowded cities, Israelis might be firing at a demonstration, and bullets could hit anyone. But once someone is shot, the presumption from the Israeli side is you have committed a crime. So if you have a bullet in you, you will be arrested. So people who go to the hospital don't want reports filed and don't want it to be known because they're afraid they'll be arrested. And in fact, in this hospital, there were 4 teenagers who had been shot at a demonstration, and they were still in surgery when Israeli soldiers came to remove them. The head of the hospital refused, said they're still receiving emergency care, and the soldiers fired tear gas canisters through the windows of the hospital, killing everyone in the neonatal unit and half the patients in the intensive care unit. So it's a very severe type of treatment. One of the things that the Israelis picked up for administering the occupation, they learned actually from the British, and it's a policy of house demolition. In many instances, someone who throws a stone at a soldier might disappear in a crowded village, and soldiers can't find them to arrest that individual. So they just pick a house at random. The owner has 15 minutes to get out of the house, and then the house is dynamited or bulldozed. And thereafter, it cannot legally be rebuilt, ever. This woman is not giving the peace sign, by the way. It's a victory sign. She's a 73-year-old whose house has just been destroyed. And this is a pretty severe form of punishment. In many instances, people will erect tents and build another house on the adjacent to the ruined house to try to keep their property. Another thing that happened under Israeli occupation is many Palestinians would be arrested and detained in Israel, which is a violation of the Geneva Convention for treatment of occupied peoples. And these children are holding a photo of their grandfather, who was an editor of a Palestinian newspaper, who was arrested. And under the occupation, Palestinians can be held for up to 6 months at a time under a provision called administrative detention, and they don't have to be charged with anything. They're supposed to be released after 6 months, but they get what is called a technical release within the prison, and then it can be renewed 24 hours later to another 6 months. Their grandfather had already been in prison for 10 years without charge. And during these imprisonments, torture is commonplace and widespread. I interviewed an 18-year-old who had just been released from prison after 6 months. He never knew why he was imprisoned. And I asked him, had he ever been tortured? And his answer was very matter-of-fact. He said, well, not every day. And I said, well, when was the last time you were tortured? He lifted up his shirt and showed me bruises all over his body and said he was beaten with iron bars by the police on the way out of the prison. I interviewed a mother of three who was a human rights activist who had been arrested. I interviewed her about a week after her release. She was held in a phone booth-sized cell for 10 days, during which time loud music was played into this tiny cell. She couldn't sit down or lie down for 4 days. She was given no food, and then food was thrown in through the window. She had to defecate and urinate in that cell. She was given no materials for her menstrual cycle. And at the end of that time, she was taken from that cell in horrible, disheveled condition and told, "We're going to bring your children to see the dog you've become." And while she was crying, they said, "Your children are in the next room. We want you to sign a list of activists' names or you won't see them." She refused. She said she didn't know anybody and she wouldn't give names anyway. And then she heard screaming in the next room. They said, "We're putting electric shocks on your children. Sign these papers. Give us names." She still refused. And then they opened the door and showed that there was a tape recording in the next room and said, "Your children aren't here and we'll never bring your children to you." And then they put a canvas bag over her head. And hot water was poured on it, and cold water. And she had marks on her bodies of cigarette burns and other things. These type of tortures have been corroborated by many human rights groups. And in fact, Israel has the distinction of being one of very few countries whose Supreme Court has three times defended the use of torture. Last year, they did a mild limitation on the use of it, but they still authorized the legal use of torture. This was a typical Israeli soldier in 1988. He carries a club. He carries a gun equipped for firing rubber bullets. He also carries a different attachment for live fire. He travels either on foot, in this case on the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem, or in a lightly armored Israeli jeep. Most of the injuries were non-lethal at that time. Lots of beatings, lots of broken bones, and injuries from rubber bullets. Occasionally, there was live fire. On the opposite side, Palestinian youth, typically referred to as the Shabab. I saw many instances of them throwing stones at Israeli soldiers, sometimes from rooftops, sometimes from hills, occasionally using slingshots to fire stones at soldiers. This boy they cover their face to protect themselves from identification. He's not using his slingshot in this instance to shoot a stone. He's got a wrapped up, balled up Palestinian flag, and he's shooting it up onto telephone wires because at that point in 88 it was illegal to display that flag. You could be arrested for that. And I just want to make it clear right now that many nonviolent activists at the time like to present this conflict as people, children throwing stones against troops armed with rubber bullets, tear gas, and live fire as sort of a David and Goliath conflict. From my perspective, being hit with a stone is still an act of violence. And I opposed it. I opposed it then. During our 30 days, there were over 30 Palestinians who were killed in the course of the time we were there, and hundreds arrested. We recorded hundreds of individual human rights abuses. There were three Israelis who were killed during the time that we were there as well. We did not see this because it occurred in Gaza, away from where we were, but the news reports were that a Palestinian had thrown a Molotov cocktail into a moving car of an Israeli settler family, and three of them were killed, a mother and two children. So there were attacks on Israelis, although less frequent during that 30-day period anyway. We hear a lot about the stone throwing, which, by the way, I never saw anyone other than teenage boys do it, and younger than teenage boys. But we didn't hear much about the nonviolent resistance to Israeli rule that took place during this first intifada, the Arab word for uprising. And that was more predominant and widespread than stone throwing. And it didn't take the forms that we would see here, demonstrations, mostly because American Palestinian nonviolent activist Mubarak Awad had organized a demonstration in Bethlehem of children, kindergarten-age children, who were carrying signs that said peace in Arabic and Hebrew, and they were tear-gassed by Israeli soldiers, and some of them actually were beaten. And many Palestinians pointed to this demonstration to say that if we held demonstrations, we will be killed. So, but they did nonviolently resist economically. There were many, many, many days where there were strikes and every business would close. You'd walk through the streets and business after business would voluntarily close to show opposition to Israeli rule. And there were tax resistance campaigns as well, especially in places like Beit Zahur. And on the opposite side, in Israel, there were Israeli demonstrators as well, largely under the umbrella of a group, a coalition group called Peace Now. This is one of about 200 demonstrators that was demonstrating outside the Ansar III prison for Palestinians in Israel. So there was an Israeli peace movement that was active at that time as well. all of this resistance came to a screeching halt in 1991 when this man, Saddam Hussein, invaded Kuwait. The Israelis immediately put the Palestinian territories under curfew. I believe it was for 60 days. And curfew is not like what we think of curfew. You can't go out after dark. It means you can't go out of your house at all. You can't even look out your window. You can be shot if you look out your window. So people close their blinds, their shutters, everything. And in the aftermath of the Gulf War, there was a little bit of rethinking and an opening between Palestinians and Israelis. And in 1993, the Oslo Accords were signed. And Yitzhak Rabin, the Labor Party Prime Minister of Israel, and Yasser Arafat signed an accord, which did a number of different things. It created the Palestinian Authority, which was a limited self-rule of Palestinians in a large part of the Gaza Strip and most of the cities of the West Bank. It allowed Arafat to return. It allowed the display of the Palestinian flag in those areas. It allowed for the creation of a Palestinian police force that would be lightly armed in those regions. And this force was given a very, very narrow mandate to enforce laws regarding Palestinians. It's not a defense force, it's a police force. There was a lot of optimism when this happened because the accords were, they set timetables for additional stages in the peace process, stages of turnover of more land, gradual turnover, cooperation of land, and ultimately a third stage that would include settlement of the refugee issue, status of Jerusalem, and creation of a Palestinian state. So if you went to Israel-Palestine in late 93 or 94, as I did, you'd find a lot of optimism. In Jerusalem, in the Old City, there would be tons of T-shirts that display both flags, doves, people talking about cooperation. People were feeling a lot of optimism. There was quite a bit of economic development in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, largely from the European Union. And the Palestinian Authority actually created a resort in Jericho with a tram and a casino. And many Israelis even started going to Jericho for weekend holidays and going even beyond there into Jordan to Petra and other places. So there was more joint business ventures between Palestinians and Israelis and a lot of optimism. Unfortunately, it became pretty clear early on that while an accord had been signed, the Labor and Likud governments had plans on the table which they never shelved to build more Jewish settlements, and that these settlements actually were escalated after Oslo. And while there was a timetable for turnover of land, Palestinians were seeing land being seized and built upon all around them. And Israelis began to put off those timetables and delay the transfer. This is the Har Homa settlement outside Jerusalem. This settlement has been opposed by three U.S. presidents, Democrat and Republican, and nonetheless it's being built. And with each of these settlements, they would, like this one, the Gilo settlement outside Jerusalem on land seized from the town of Beit Jala, there's an access road, sometimes extremely substantial roads that have tunnels and heavy gauge concrete. And these roads allow the settlers to travel from settlement to settlement and also into Israel without going through Palestinian towns or by any Palestinian land. So when one of these roads is built, by law, a Palestinian can't travel on it and can't even go within hundreds of meters of it. And if you look at a map, and I've got one map up there from the Boston Globe on the front table that shows the increased settlements, picture roads connecting all of them. And picture what this means to the Palestinian farmer or merchant or doctor, because each of those roads traps you and traps you further and further economically and politically. And makes it clear very early on that when you build this kind of infrastructure, you invest hundreds of millions of dollars in roads and settlements, that Israel is not really planning to turn over that land to you. And with the increase in settlements, there were increases of attacks by settlers, like this Palestinian family's car that was burned the night before by a vigilante group of settlers from the Kiryat Arba settlement outside of Hebron. And this is not just these are not just racist attacks, they're with purpose. A Palestinian car is burned, their crops are set on fire, their house is attacked. Some of the Palestinian families might panic and leave their home. If a home is left empty for a certain period of time, Israelis can occupy it and raise the Israeli flag, and the land ceases to be Palestinian land, and then a settlement can be built in that land. And so it's part of an active campaign to terrorize and drive people out of the territory. And since you're under military occupation, you don't have a normal structure of police investigation and so on. The soldiers who are there to protect the settlers and to do security over you. The police who are there are few and far between and not very responsive. So it's a pretty rough situation. And while most of the urban areas were now controlled by the Palestinian Authority, there are some exceptions. One is the center of Hebron, where there is the unusual circumstance. There is a Jewish settlement of 500 people in the center of the old city of Hebron, which is a overwhelmingly Muslim Palestinian city, a large city. And this settlement is surrounded by an area controlled by 1,500 Israeli soldiers, by a Palestinian area. So there are Palestinians within that Israeli-controlled area of the settlement. And there they still have curfews, where the only people who can walk in the streets are soldiers, internationals, or Jewish settlers. And when I walked through the streets of Hebron on two occasions, I saw all the shuttered Palestinian businesses and homes were marked with the Star of David and with graffiti in Hebrew proclaiming that the Arabs should leave and the land really belongs to Jews only. And you can see how this graffiti was painted previously and painted over with white and done again. And as a religious studies major, this was really particularly shocking to me because it was using the Star of David as a racist emblem. And I just could not believe that people could do such a thing, given the history of Judaism and the use of racist emblems on Jewish homes and businesses and in other places, continuing even sometimes to our own day. And also, one of the things that became clear to people by 96, 97 is that every Palestinian-controlled city or town had a checkpoint or two checkpoints for entrance and egress, and soldiers could delay people for hours and hours and deny people arbitrarily the ability to go from one town to another, to a hospital, to a friend's house, to a family reunion, anything. And all the other means of entrance and egress from a particular town, there may be 10 roads out of a city, the Israelis would build barricades like this. So if you want to go from Bethlehem to Hebron, for example, a distance of 15 miles, you drive your car to one of these barriers, you park it there, you walk over, you go through a 100-meter sort of empty area, you go over another barricade, then you get a taxi to the outside of Hebron, and you repeat the drill over two more barricades. And so, but if you're, it's very, very, very difficult. But if you're a farmer trying to deliver tomatoes or grapes or olives, it's devastating. And with these, and Palestinians began to conclude that they had not gained independence and were not on the road to independence, but they had actually been trapped in economically inviolable, impoverished ghettos, and that they were really being under worse conditions after Oslo rather than better ones. Now, we hear a lot in the United States about Palestinian terrorism. Every Palestinian terrorist attack is going to be reported here, and it should be. But we don't hear so much about Israeli and Jewish terrorism, like the attacks on the cars that I showed you earlier. This is the site of one attack that did reach the Western press pretty extensively. This is in Hebron. It's the Tomb of Abraham, one of two spots in the West Bank that is sacred to Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And it has the distinction of being the only building that I've ever heard of where there is a synagogue and a mosque in the same building. They hold prayers at different hours, and there's a substantial Israeli military presence there to enforce security. In 1996, though, Dr. Baruch Goldstein from the nearby Kiryat Arba settlement entered the mosque during prayer carrying three machine guns, and he opened fire on the praying Muslims. He killed more than 32 and injured more than 112 before he was finally beaten to death by the surviving Muslims. In response to this, Israeli soldiers made no attempt to stop him at any time. In response to this attack, Palestinian leaders were waiting for a crackdown on the radical settler movement and the arrest of supporters and so on. But what the Israelis did instead is they put a 60-day-long curfew on the entire occupied territories. The Palestinians today refer to that sarcastically as they were punished and they were guilty of the crime of being massacred. See, if a Palestinian does an act of terrorism, there's corporate punishment. If an Israeli does an act of terrorism, there's corporate punishment. Always the victims are the Palestinians.